But we turn now to God's Word this morning. And over the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at the book of Esther. Today we're going to look at the final section of the book of Esther, chapters 8 to 10. And you'll find that on page 506 in the church Bibles. And as we look at these final chapters of Esther, we want to try to sum up the central message of the book. And I think that we can do that with one word, providence. In the first part of the service, occasionally we'll look at a question from the shorter catechism. And I've been calling it a list of questions and answers. And one of the last questions we looked at was, what is God's providence? And the answer was, God's providence is His completely holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing every creature and every action. That's a bit of a mouthful, but it gives us the idea. I'll repeat it for us. God's providence is His completely holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing every creature and every action. Another definition says, the world and humanity are not ruled by chance or by fate, but by God, who directs history and creation towards an ultimate goal. That's a bit clearer, but we could still improve on it slightly. Providence says that the world and humanity are not ruled by chance or by fate, but by God, who directs history and creation toward His ultimate goal. And as one writer puts it, God does this providential directing through the normal actions of people in the normal order of life. We've seen that although God is never mentioned directly in this book of Esther, He is at the center of the book. Those of us who accept what the rest of Scripture tells us about God can't fail to see God as the hero of this book. He is the unseen ruler who works sovereignly and providentially through everyday events and through everyday human decisions. God can and He does do miracles, but that is not how He normally works. As we saw last week, our God is so great, so powerful, that He can work without miracles through the ordinary events of billions of human lives through millennia of time to accomplish His eternal purposes and His ancient promises. And what is the ultimate goal that God is working towards? The punishment of His enemies and the salvation of His people. We've seen that as we've looked at chapters 1 to 7. Haman rose up to threaten God's people with destruction. And although Mordecai and Esther stood up against Haman, it was God who worked providentially to bring about Haman's defeat. And as we've looked at this book, we've seen something else. The historical events in the book of Esther are a little snapshot of the experience of God's people as a whole. Time after time throughout history, God's people have faced situations where God seemed to be uninterested. It seemed that He had abandoned His people. Time after time, enemies have risen up to threaten God's people. And time after time, God has providentially worked to defeat those enemies. We noticed last week that the greatest defeat for the enemy of God and His people occurred at the cross. Jesus' death was supposed to be Satan's greatest triumph, but it turned into His decisive defeat. The war against the enemy has been won. We have yet to see the full outworkings of that victory. There are still battles to be fought, but the enemy has been defeated. His power is broken. The war has been won. That's our situation today. And when we look at the book of Esther, that was the situation of God's people in Persia. When we left the book, Haman had been executed. But God's people are not yet able to enter into victory celebrations. Why? Because they're still under a decree of death. Haman is gone, but his decree is still in place. The order has gone out all across Persia to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. And the date has been set for just a few months away. So we pick up in Esther chapter 8, verse 1. That same day, that's the day Haman was executed, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then the king extended the gold scepter to Esther, and she rose and stood before him. If it pleases the king, she said, and if he regards me with favor and thinks it is the right thing to do, and if he is pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy all the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have hanged him on the gallows. Now write another decree in the king's name on behalf of the Jews as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked. At once the royal secretaries were summoned. On the 23rd day of the third month, the month of Sivan, they wrote out all Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the satraps, governors, and nobles of the 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. These orders were written in the script of each province and the language of each people, and also to the Jews in their own script and language. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted couriers, who rode fast horses especially bred for the king. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, riding the royal horses, raced out, spurred on by the king's command. And the edict was also issued in the citadel of Susa. A new authority and a new decree. In many ways, Xerxes is a non-character in this book. He supposedly has great power, but he's constantly handing that power over to others. In this book, he never once fails to do what anyone asks of him or what anyone suggests to him. That was true in the case of Haman, and it's true now in the case of Esther and Mordecai. We saw last week that a great reversal occurred between Haman and Mordecai, and now that is completed. Mordecai ends up with Haman's property, and the king's signet ring that has been reclaimed from Haman is now given to Mordecai. The individual who had the ring could act with the king's authority. When Haman had asked the king to have the Jews destroyed, Xerxes had given him the ring, and Haman had issued the decree. And it is that decree which Esther now pleads with the king about. And we might think, why doesn't Xerxes just repeal the decree? But for all Xerxes' power, he is bound by the law. In chapter 1, we were told that once a decree was written in the laws of Persia and Media, it could not be repealed. Haman's decree of death has to stand. The only way forward was to issue another decree that would counteract the first one. And so the king says in verse 8, "Write another decree in the king's name on behalf of the Jews as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked." And so the second decree was written, and sealed with the same ring that sealed the first decree. Verse 9 says that the decree is published just as widely as Haman's decree. It's carried to all 127 provinces of the empire in the language of each people. But there's a far greater urgency to this second decree. The speed of the couriers is emphasized for us. Verse 10 says the dispatches were sent by mounted couriers who rode fast horses especially bred for the king. And in verse 14, the couriers riding the royal horses raced out, spurred on by the king's command. What's the hurry? Well, chapter 3 told us that Haman's decree of death went out on the 13th day of the first month. The day of death was set for the 13th day of the 12th month. And by this point in time, according to chapter 8, verse 9, it's the 23rd day of the third month. Time is ticking away. The Greek historian Herodotus estimated that it would take 3 months for the decree to reach the furthest parts of the empire. Men and women under the decree of death need to hear the decree of life before it's too late. And you may have noticed that the second decree parallels the first one almost word for word. Both decrees will come into effect on the same day, the 13th day of the 12th month. On that day, the enemies of God's people will attempt to destroy, kill, and annihilate them, and to plunder their property. But according to verse 11, the king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. You notice here that the Jews are not the aggressors. The decree allows them to fight to defend themselves from those who are intent on destroying them. There are only two possible outcomes. Either God's people will be destroyed, or their enemies will be destroyed. Until the judgment day, the 13th day of the 12th month, both will live side by side. But on that day, the enemies of God's people will assemble, and they will be intent on absolute victory. They'll either succeed, or they themselves will be destroyed. And the obvious question is, wouldn't the Jews have tried to defend themselves anyway? Surely they didn't need a new decree to give them permission. And no doubt they would have tried to defend themselves. But this decree makes a crucial difference. We've seen a new authority and a new decree, and now in verses 15 to 17, we see the consequences of the new authority and the new decree. Joy for God's people, and a grave warning for those who do not belong to God's people. Chapter 8, verse 15. Mordecai left the king's presence wearing royal garments of blue and white, and a large crown of gold and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. When the decree of death went out in chapter 3, we were told the city of Susa was bewildered. Now we read in chapter 8, verse 15, the city of Susa held a celebration. Chapter 4 told us that when the Jews heard the decree of death, in every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Now we're told, in chapter 8, verse 17, in every province and every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. What has made the difference? This new decree announces that a new authority is in place. The enemy, Haman, has been defeated. And now God's people have two representatives in the throne room. Esther pleads their case with the king, and Mordecai is wearing royal robes. Two of their own people are their advocates with the king, and the king listens to them. So as God's people prepare to fight, they now have great comfort and courage and confidence. This new decree has changed everything. Their wailing has been turned into dancing. However, this new decree is a double-edged sword. To God's people, it's a decree of life. But for the enemies of God and his people, to those who persist in their opposition to God and his people, this new decree is a decree of death. When the judgment day comes, the 13th day of the 12th month, those who remain enemies of God and his people will have no hope. The preservation of God's people means the destruction of the enemies of God and his people. And so after we're told that the Jews were feasting and celebrating, we read in verse 17, many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. Other translations say they identified themselves with the Jews, or they sided with the Jews. Clearly, there's no middle ground here. Men and women are either with God's people or they're against them. Those who don't join God's people are choosing to take their stand against God's people. One commentator puts it like this: life and death are determined by identification with a people. Identify with God's people and live, or identify with the enemies of God and his people and die. And if we pause here, we can see great similarities with our situation today. The Bible tells us that the whole world is under a decree of death. Every man or woman born into this world is stained by sin. God is a good and perfect God. He cannot ignore rebellion and sin. When sin runs its course, it leads to death. We're all sinful, and therefore we're all condemned to die. But the New Testament tells us that Jesus Christ won a great victory at the cross. His death and resurrection broke the power of sin and death for everyone who trusts in him. At the cross, God the Father issued a new decree, a decree of life. Those who put their trust in Jesus' work on the cross are delivered from the decree of death. They're delivered from the power of sin and death. We've seen that when the decree of life was issued in the book of Esther, there was no middle ground. Men and women either identified themselves with God's people, they joined God's people, or they took their stand against them. And of course, many people today would say, well, yes, that happened in Esther, but it's ridiculous to say that I'm like that with Jesus. I haven't given my life to him, I haven't submitted to him as Lord, but I'm not against him. I'm in a neutral position. You may see yourself in a neutral position, but God does not. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus said to the crowds who came to hear him, he who is not with me is against me. There's no middle ground. There's no sitting on the fence. At this very moment, each one of us is either among God's people or we're among the enemies of God and his people. It all depends on what we do with Jesus. Each one of us is either with him or we're against him. If we fail to hand over our lives to him, then we are against him. No matter how outwardly moral or kind or religious our lives seem to be. So far we've seen a new authority and a new decree. And we've seen the consequences of the new authority and the new decree. Joy for God's people and a grave warning for those who do not belong to God's people. And now in chapter 9, verses 1 to 19, we find victory, celebration, and rest. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities and all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them, because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed Parshandatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Boratha, Adalia, Aridatha, Parmashta, Arisai, Aridai, and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. The number of those slain in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? It will also be granted." "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on gallows." So the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they hanged the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and to get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but did not lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th, So then on the 15th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why rural Jews, those who live in villages, observe the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day of giving presents to each other. No doubt some of the details here are quite disturbing to us. And so we need to notice some things in the text. First of all, what happens here is essentially a war. As we've seen, the Jews are not the aggressors. As they defended themselves, they turned the tables on the aggressors. Verse 1 of chapter 9 is a key verse. It reminds us that both decrees came into effect on the same day. And then it says, "On this day the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them." As we've said, there's no middle ground. The enemies of God's people have only one aim: to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. No doubt that's why the fighting was so extensive and why so many died. The enemies of God's people can't win, but they have committed themselves to their cause. And so they don't surrender. They don't negotiate for peace. They fight to the death. And so the fighting must continue until they're destroyed. And notice something else which the text emphasizes for us. The Jews did not lay their hands on the plunder. That statement is repeated 3 times, so we know that it's important. It emphasizes for us that the Jews were not motivated by greed or by a desire for material gain. They were fighting for survival and to destroy the armies of the ancient enemy. They weren't fighting to line their own pockets. And this comment about not laying their hands on the plunder has a wider significance as well. We noticed in previous weeks that Haman was an Agagite. That is, he was a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites. The Amalekites had set themselves as enemies of God's people from the time God's people came into being. And many generations before the book of Esther, Saul, the first king of Israel, had been commanded by God to wipe out the Amalekites. And he was specifically told by God not to keep any plunder for himself. But in 1 Samuel chapter 15, we read that not only did Saul fail to wipe out the Amalekites, we're told he pounced on the plunder. And we're told that this was evil in the eyes of the Lord. Why? Because it sent a mixed signal. Was Saul fighting the Amalekites to get hold of their stuff, their sheep and their cattle? Or was he fighting for the Lord and for his people? Here in Esther, God's people don't make the same mistake. They did not lay their hands on the plunder. Also, by sparing King Agag, Saul had ensured that his descendants would be around to threaten God's people in the future. But here in Esther, Agag's descendants are wiped out. And that's the point of carefully and laboriously mentioning all of Haman's 10 sons in verses 7 to 9. Obviously, those 10 sons were part of the forces that were attacking the Jews, but none of them survived. Hundreds of years before, God himself had promised that he would be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. And here he ensures that this particular ancient enemy will not rise again. The mission that King Saul had abandoned has finally been completed hundreds of years later. Finally, God's people have rest. And they celebrate. There's joy and feasting. Just as there had been when the decree of life was issued in chapter 8. In a sense, the joy here at the end of the battle is no greater than the joy before the battle. The decree had given God's people assurance of victory. But now that the battle is over, they can fully enjoy the rest that had been promised by that decree. And again, we can notice great similarities between these events in Esther and what the Bible tells us about the end of history. Parts of the book of Revelation tell us about the great final judgment day, the day when both decrees will come into effect. The decree of eternal death as just punishment for rebellion and sin, and the decree of eternal life for those who have trusted in Christ. And this great final judgment day will play out much like the judgment day in Esther. Revelation chapter 19 tells us that the armies of heaven, led by the risen Christ, will line up to face their enemies, all those who have refused to join God's people. At the beginning of chapter 19, Jesus is described as a rider on a white horse, leading his enemies to battle. And then we read, in John's words, "Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against the rider on the white horse and his army. But the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who had performed the miraculous signs on his behalf. With these signs he had deluded those who had received the mark of the beast and worshipped his image. The two of them were thrown alive into the fiery lake of burning sulfur, and the rest of them were killed with the sword that came out of the mouth of the rider on the horse, and all the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. These are unsettling words, but they're words that we need to hear. The rebellion of God's enemies will not go unpunished. Yes, we heard earlier from 2 Peter, God is patient, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. But those who persist in rebellion will not go unpunished. Just as Haman and his followers were punished, so Satan and his followers will be punished forever. God is providentially directing history and creation towards his ultimate goal: the punishment of his enemies and the salvation of his people. He is a good and a perfect God. He cannot and he will not ignore sin and injustice and rebellion. And as we consider this picture of the end of history, we have to realize that all of us will be involved, on one side or the other. There's no middle ground. There's no sitting on the fence. Every one of us will line up for this battle, either among God's people, led by the risen Christ, or among the enemies of God and his people. It all depends on what we do with Jesus. Are we with him or against him? We've already seen that the war was won long ago. Satan was defeated at the cross. Yes, he's filled with fury, but he's lost the war. On the last great judgment day, there can only be one outcome: victory for God's people, led by the risen Christ. If you know that you're not with Christ, or if you're not quite sure what this is all about, then please come and talk to me afterwards. Talk to one of the other members of this church. Make sure you belong to Christ. We've seen God's people enjoy victory, celebration, and rest. And at the end of the book of Esther, we're told about the memorial of victory and rest. Chapter 9, verse 20. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy, and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote to them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy, and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Notice what is being memorialized. It's not the death of their enemies. No, in verse 22, they are to celebrate annually the time the Jews got relief from their enemies. They're to celebrate the rest that flows from their God-given victory. And so the annual day of celebration is set not for the day when they defeated their enemies. No, it's set for the day after the battle finished, the day when they rested. And notice how they're to celebrate this feast, or this rest, with feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. This is not a celebration of death and destruction. It's a celebration of God's deliverance, his provision, his gift of life. So it's a memorial of victory and rest. And Jewish men and women today still celebrate this feast. But Christians don't. Why not? Because Jesus Christ has given us a greater feast to celebrate. A feast celebrating the greatest victory and the greatest rest. And we'll be celebrating that feast this evening. We call it the Lord's Supper. We've already noticed that we're all born under a decree of death because of our sin. But when Jesus died and rose again, a second decree was issued, a decree of life. When we eat the bread and drink the wine, we celebrate that decree of life. Christ was sinless, yet he was punished for sin so that you and I wouldn't have to be. Christ has defeated Satan and sin and death. Their power has been broken, and the Lord's Supper is a feast celebrating Christ's victory and celebrating the rest that his people enjoy. Rest from the burden of our sin. Rest from trying to make it on our own in life. But there's a significant difference between the feast we celebrate and the feast in Esther. The feast in Esther was not set up until after the 13th day of the 12th month, after the great battle had been won. But the feast we celebrate was set up after the cross. The final judgment day has not yet come for us. The last great battle is still ahead of us. But this feast reminds us that the war has already been won. Satan was decisively defeated at the cross, even though he fights on furiously. The feast in Esther only looked backwards to a victory in Persia. Our feast looks both backwards and forwards. Backwards to the cross, and forwards to Christ's final victory over God's enemies. Our feast is only a temporary feast. We celebrate it until he comes, until Christ returns. And in our daily lives, this feast gives us comfort and courage and confidence. The war has been won, and one day the final battle will be won. Whatever we have to face, our future is secure. One day we will celebrate and enjoy rest in God's presence forever. And no trouble or hardship in this life can take that away from us. Before we leave the book of Esther, there's one more thing that we need to notice. It's the name given to this feast, Purim, which literally means lot or chance. Verse 23 and following of chapter 9 remind us that when Haman had been scheming against the Jews, he had cast the poor, he had thrown the dice. And he did that to decide on his future plans. And of course, those who will not accept that God rules sovereignly and providentially over this world, those people must read the events of this book as a result of chance. The events in this book have to be seen as a series of remarkable coincidences. Vashti just happened to be removed from her position. Esther just happened to replace her. Mordecai's loyalty to the king just happened to be overlooked. The king just happened to be in a good mood the day Esther broke the rules and came unsummoned into his presence. The king just happened to have a sleepless night and read about Mordecai's loyalty the very day that Haman came to ask for Mordecai's death. And so on, and so on, and so on. But as he wrote this book, the writer of Esther was pushing us to ask the question, are all these events really just happening? Is this all just a series of remarkable coincidences? And by calling this annual memorial feast Purim, chance, the question has been set down for generations to come. Have a look at chapter 9, verse 28. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation, by every family, and in every province, and in every city. And these days of Purim should never cease to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of them die out among their descendants. The final verses of Esther tell us about the continued success of Esther and Mordecai. They tell us about their work to make sure this memorial feast was celebrated. Every year, God's people would celebrate these days of chance. And each new generation would have to consider, are these really days of chance? Or are they days of providence? The Bible makes it clear that God's people in Esther and God's people today live in days of providence. Jesus' death on the cross did not happen by chance. It was not an unfortunate end to the life of a promising young teacher. It was part of God's sovereign, providential work, directing history and creation towards His ultimate goal. In the book of Acts, after Jesus had risen from the dead, His followers prayed these words. Sovereign Lord, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. Even the horror of the cross was not outside of God's providence. It was God's way of saving His people from their sins. You and I do not live in days of chance. We live in days of providence. And our calling is to be faithful and obedient to God and His word. He is at work for His own glory and for the good of His people. Each week, as we've looked at the book of Esther, we've finished with these words from Romans chapter 8. And they're a good way to conclude our study of this book. In all things, God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. We live in days of providence. And this truth gives us comfort and courage and confidence. And so our closing hymn says, "Be still, my soul, the Lord."